While everybody's getting their seats and getting their equipment all attached, I will take this opportunity to welcome you all here. My name is Pamela Aul. I'm head of the education program at USIP. And this program is that we're about to hear is one of the areas which brings together many programs at USIP. Even though we have an education program, we have very strong interest in education in the religion and peacemaking program and in the conflict analysis and prevention program. So we all three are joining together to bring you this program this morning. And I think that I just want to explain why a place like U.S. Institute of Peace is really interested in education in Pakistan. And it's partly because of where we come from. We were established with the understanding that high politics isn't everything in life. That unless you understand what's going on deep in society, you will never understand how to, in fact, address a conflict. So from its very beginning, USIP had a strong interest in not only working with teachers and students, but working through education systems or programs or schools to address conflict. We do all of this abroad. We do not work with conflict in this country, but we work with a lot of faculty and students in this country. But when we're talking about actually working through an education system to address conflict, we are doing that in places like Iraq, the Middle East, Israeli-Palestinian conflict, Sudan, Philippines, and we have always had a strong interest in South Asia. And so we're very pleased that you have joined us this morning for this program. I'm very excited to hear from Professor Andrabi. Married to an economist as I am, I think this is very exciting when an economist comes to visit us here at the Institute. What we are going to do is I'm about to turn over the introductions to Chris. Is that right?
Absolutely, yes. Can do that.
And but just briefly to introduce my two colleagues to my direct left, Kumar Ulhuda.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Ulhuda, is in the Religion and Peacemaking program. He is has been a professor of Islamic Studies and Comparative Religions at Boston College and is an expert on Pakistan. And to his left, Christine Fair, is the Institute's key person on Pakistan and also South Asia in general. She has written on all sorts of subjects, including the security forces, etc. But she's just finished a very interesting study on the madrasas in Pakistan. So both... Perhaps she's thinking
reviving,
of
it. Reviving, trying very, very hard.
And both of them will serve as discussants for this presentation.
Well, thank you. Well, I'm delighted to present Tahir Andrabi. For those of you who know his work, he really came to prominence when he wrote what I think was a path-breaking paper on madrasas in Pakistan. It was thanks to Tahir's research team that an egregious math error perpetrated by the ICG was discovered, that in fact 33% of students in Pakistan don't attend madrasas, the big denominator problem, that in fact something like 3-4%, rather than dividing by 19 million their denominator, they divide it by 1.9. So for those of you who are familiar with the paper that he wrote on madrasas, a look at the data, or something to that effect, he made an enormous contribution to our understanding about the madrasa policy problematic. Now, today he's going to be talking about something very different. He's going to be talking about private education in Pakistan. Thanks to his work, as well as the work of his colleagues, there's been a lot of revelation about private schooling in Pakistan. I think the conventional wisdom is that only rich folks can send their kids to private schools. And a number of people at the World Bank as well as at academic institutions have actually shown that that's really not the case. And in fact, if you take a look at census data as well as the Pakistani Integrated Household Survey, about 30% of families in Pakistan nationwide send their kids to private schools. And there have been a number of very interesting studies about returns to private schooling. Given the investment, there's been some concern about the quality of education they produce and so forth. So once we sort of get this technicality issue resolved, Tahir is going to be presenting his work, A Dime a Day, which is looking at private schooling opportunities in Pakistan.
Okay. Well, I can talk through it. I mean, that's okay. Just give me a second. Our work on the genesis of the madrasa paper really did not start off as a project looking at the madrasa. I'm not by any means a specialist on religion or anything of that sort, and even not an educationist as such. I'm an economist. And our really comparative advantage is looking at data and thinking about data in a very micro way. We think that, in fact, all data really is based on micro data. And so most of our work is trying to find data at the smallest unit possible, most aggregated unit. I think that's really important. And always trying to look at as much of the primary data that that we can get at. Okay, why don't you do that? And then I'll start.
You'll start while you look for another laptop? Okay,
yeah.
Thanks.
Let's see. Okay. This is joint work with Jishnu Das and Asim Khaja, Jishnu at the World Bank and Asim at the Kennedy School. My contention is that the rise of private schools and not madrasas is the most significant and interesting phenomenon in education in the last 15 years. Okay, and I think that I want to have certain keywords kind of embedded in your mind, which really is not associated with the private schools typically when one thinks of Pakistan or anywhere else in the world for that matter, which is think of poor, think of rural, and think of female. Okay, these are words that typically are associated with very bad kinds of outcomes of all kinds, but I want you to keep that in mind. Particularly, we have a very interesting, just to give you a flavor of the end results, I don't want to wait too long for the punchline, which is that we want to really think about low-cost private schools. And I want to show that low-cost private schools are actually very prevalent. And then the question we ask is, how can they sustain such low cost? And for that, low fees and low cost, and how can they sustain it? And that gets us to the single most important component in any schooling finance, which is teachers. Teachers typically are roughly 2/3 of costs in a school in Pakistan, with low infrastructure costs. So that's what we want to focus on a lot, is looking at where do teachers come from, how much they are paid, etc., and how does that matter? And I my sense is, that is one of the most interesting things going on in Pakistan, which is what is happening with teachers. So this is a very supply-side view as such. Most people typically think of education in demand context, right? So when you think about demand for education, as mothers, people not willing to send their girls to school, or even in school choice, people with extremist bent sending their kids to madrasas, those are demand-side constructs. What we are thinking about more is like a cost-side argument, which is trying to think where do schools arise. So not so much demand, but a supply as an additional factor. And I think it's in Pakistan, both in government and private school, supply is actually a very important issue. And government supply really is important because where do where are schools created? I'm doing a large project in Sindh where it's a very serious issue in school construction, school location, etc. So supply issues are independently important in Pakistan, both for private and public. I'm going to actually talk about some results which are not in the paper which is another paper, but we are I wanted to bring them in here, which is the interesting question is on quality. That's something which is our latest work, and we think that's work which is has really not been done in Pakistan at all. And in fact, the kinds of way we are doing hasn't really been done by the World Bank in any other country. So this is really work that we have invested a lot of time in the last 3 years working on this. So you'll be one of the first people to get a flavor of those results. I wanted to talk about those very clearly. So there is issue of quality. And then when we talk about private schools, it's very natural for us to use private schools as a counterpart to looking at government schools. And there, one of the interesting questions that we think about, particularly as it relates to teachers, is thinking about incentives. Incentives and effort, and how do they really matter? Okay. Pakistan demographics. I mean, this audience is very familiar with Pakistani demographics. It's a large country, roughly 140 million people. What many know is that it's also a very young country, right? 50% of population in Pakistan in the 90th century is below age 17. So if you look at like school-going kids, age 5 to 15, there are roughly 50 million kids. Okay, and just over half of these are in school by most estimates. Roughly 2 million young people enter the labor market every year. Okay, so people coming out of the schooling system or at least of school age, people coming. If you look at Pakistan's population graph, right, if you look at the US population graph, right, it's like a python that has swallowed a rat, right, with a baby boomer being the bulge and moving up, right, so it's like this. Pakistan's population graph looks like a Christmas tree, which is that every successive cohort in Pakistan is bigger than the older cohort. So 5 to 9 is bigger than 10 to 14, 15 to, and 10 to 14 is bigger than 15 to 19. So we have yet to identify the Pakistani baby boomers, okay? So what's the good news? The good news is that the Pakistani social security crisis is about 65 years away because the aging of the population is not our problem right now in Pakistan. I just want to give you some sense of scale and scope. The province of Punjab, for instance, in Pakistan, just to give you some numbers on it, has roughly 250,000 teachers. There are 63,000 public schools, government schools in Punjab alone, which is a provincial, that education is a provincial subject provided by the provinces. So this one province, which is about two-thirds of the Pakistani population, has a current enrollment roughly around 10 million. Potential enrollment in Punjab can be as high as 20 million. To give you an example, where I come from in California, where California is the largest state in the U.S., current California enrollment, latest K-12, is 6.2 million. Okay, so we're talking about very large educational systems, and I want you to keep that in mind. To give you another example, just rural Sindh, which is considered a really backwater in Pakistan, as far as education is concerned, not in the news, except in kind of local politics, has 35,000 government schools. So when you think about the educational landscape in Pakistan, it is and you start thinking about reform and start thinking about education, you start getting a sense of how large it is. Pakistan is typically known for its low educational attainment, its net enrollment rate. There's no official net enrollment rate, roughly just over 50%. Pakistan is low even in South Asian context. There is 83% in net enrollment in India, 90% in Sri Lanka, 70% in Nepal. And relative to its income, if you look at cross-country data, you look at typical income levels for Pakistan, and you compare Vietnam, right? That's an obvious comparison. It's very similar income levels to Pakistan. Our enrollment is much less. Pakistan is roughly 3/4 of what it should be, given these cross-country comparisons. You can take them for whatever you want to take them for. It's not a flat plane as far as low income is concerned. There are large disparities, and there is a 20 percentage point difference roughly between boys and girls enrollment. There is enrollment in the highest expenditure decile, the top 10%. Enrollment is twice as much as the lowest 10%, and then rural ratios are less, right? So rural female poor are really typically the stratification in the Pakistani education system. Rural female enrollment ratio in these household surveys roughly comes to around 36%. All right.
Yay, thank you.
Okay.
Thank you so much. Sorry to disrupt your morning.
You deserve a prize.
Okay.
Dime a day.
Oh, 8 rupees.
Okay.
Thank you. Again.
Thanks a lot. And and the mouse? If I want to use the mouse? Because I have these graphs that I want to move through. And this into it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. Okay, thanks. Oh, so it's turning over there. Okay.
Yeah. Not scrolling down.
Hey, you left too early.
Yeah.
Hang on.
You need to click on resume slideshow.
Yeah,
oh.
Yeah. No.
Oh, ooh. Yeah, click on this dump.
Yeah, that's what I was doing.
You're in the wrong view.
Yeah.
Go to view.
Go slideshow. Because I'm not seeing it here.
Right, so you're not in the slideshow. Go right there.
Yeah.
Right, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Here, go up to the top of your slideshow.
Dropouts are pretty serious, and that's something that people haven't really fully looked at. There's been some work done on trying to understand dropouts, but I think the implication of dropouts hasn't really been understood. By the end of grade 3, 50% of children who have enrolled will have left school forever. Okay, enrollment peaks in Pakistan around age 9. Okay, so if you look at age, number of people, percentage of specific age groups who are enrolled, it's a curve like this. It's a curve like this in most countries, but Pakistan's curve is shifted quite dramatically to the left. The standard story in government schools is that they are of bad quality, underfunded. The reality is that evidence on government school quality is very scanty. Okay, it's very non-systematic, it's very anecdotal. Most of us know, typically when you ask Pakistanis, you know, what do you think of the schooling system? I was just talking to some people from RTI, and you know, so the standard story is, well, we think it's bad because, you know, you ask somebody to write an application, people with VAMA cannot write a letter in English, things like that. Systematic work on quality really hasn't happened. What about madrasas? Chris is here, who's done a lot of work on madrasas, knows more about it than just about anybody else. Madrasas, the standard story is a fallback option for the vast majority, which is typically the standard story is that people exit the government schooling system because of its bad quality. The rich exit to the private schools, and the poor have no choice but to go to madrasas. Our reality is that it's a limited enrollment. If I can do it, I can, you know. Just hit it. Okay. One of the main results that we found in our madrasa study was that when school alternatives are absent, kids don't go to madrasa, kids drop out. I mean, lack of enrollment is a real issue, it's not madrasa enrollment. So when you look at poor, when you look at people with bad characteristics, they actually drop out. Secondly, the household behavior that we found in madrasa enrollment was quite complicated. It was not that, you know, certain types of people were sending their kids to madrasas. So it is generally true that slightly poorer people were sending more. But the interesting question that we found was that there were people, a lot of variation within family. Within the family, some kids were being sent to madrasas and some not. I want to make one point. It's not a study to talk about madrasas, which is the position that I want to take is really an econometrician. Okay, I mean, I'm not here to talk about foreign policy and extremism and things like that. That's really not my call. But I want to talk about causality. Okay. Which is that typically, I think there is a lot of what I would call reverse causality. At least, it is as likely as this. But the causality issue is that madrasas cause extremism. Okay, so, and they are a source. My view is that it could very well be, I don't know, but it could very well be that the causality is that extremist people use madrasas. It's not that madrasas call Islamism, that madrasas are used by Islamist people. So, and I think there is some support for that in the sense that, or at least any hypothesis, think about all the research done on education in the United States. It is almost impossible in the US to come up with any single statement on what causes what in education. Okay, look at, in California the big discussion is on class size. To actually say that class size improves educational outcomes, to me seems pretty natural as a parent, but there is no study that can show it. It's so hard. So to say that inputs affect outputs is a very difficult problem. To actually say that schools affect children's attitudes, to show that formally, forget about madrasa, think about your own kids' schools, is very hard, because it's so difficult to disentangle all the various inputs that go in. There is so much sorting in school choice. So I think that point really has to be taken very seriously. Private schools. The standard story on private schools, this is from a Pakistan government document, Ministry of Education, 2005. Okay? The standard story is that because of the use of English as a medium of instruction and high fee structure, these institutions are best suited to serve the requirement of need population. And this is also a direct quote. The second one, thus their role in universalization remains only marginal. Okay, so this is the 2005 Government of Pakistan document. The Government of Pakistan's view really is that the big impulse there is to regulate private schools, the fees are too high, and they're gouging. And basically what they're looking at is, in Pakistani typical bureaucratic style, is outside the window and the school that they see in Islamabad. Okay. Now, the reality, is that there has been explosive growth in private schools since 1980. Okay. 2,500 new private schools between 1994-95, 8,000 between 1999-2000. Okay, this is my favorite graph. Open. You can go open link. I guess you click on it and right click open link and that one. Back. I made a fancy PowerPoint, but you would go to that.
What do you think this is? The Army?
Seriously?
Okay.
The Army requires two PowerPoints, one on either side of the screen.
Yeah. Now, even at Pomona College, we have these two things, right? So, for the audience, so that people don't. The private schools are setting up in rural areas as well. Every second village in Punjab will have a private school within 5 to 7 years. Currently, right now, most of the growth in private school is coming from rural areas, and we think that this growth will continue for sure. In fact, the latest numbers, which haven't come out yet, but we have seen some summary numbers from the National Education Census 2005, suggest that this trend has really continued. It's a market-based phenomenon, okay? Private schools. Most private schools that are in the data are self-owned, okay? Because typically, I didn't write that in, right? But the third segment of the schooling population in Pakistan is the non-profit sector, right? So you have NGO schools, you have foundation schools, you have trust schools, and so on. And if you ask people, the general view is, it agrees. People are supposed to know better, right? Typically say, our view is that tell us about NGO schools in the rural areas and all that. And if I could have opened this graph, I would have shown you that it is the non-profit sector within private school is less than 20%. So more than 80% of private schools are self-owned, for-profit, and they're typically mom-and-pop type schools. Most of the growth in self-owned schools, if you look at the newer schools, so it is very true that if you look at the data, schools that were formed before 1980, a vast majority of the schools, or 60% of the schools formed before 1980, are non-profit schools. So these are foundation schools, typically what we associated with private schools. But if you look at this 90s boom, it really is the for-profit sector. Private schools are affordable. The ratio of private school fees to median per capita income is 2.5% in Punjab. Okay. I'll give you an example, it's 9% in the US. Right? They're low both absolutely and relatively. If you translate it, it's actually less than a dime a day. Right? We use the term dime a day because a dollar a day is the poverty line. right, if you think of it as the international poverty line. In fact, the rupee has depreciated. It's actually, I was trying to think whether I can, we can rechange it to a nickel a day, given what has happened in the last 2 years with the rupee. But it's still, it's between a nickel and a dime. Okay. Maybe we should call it nickel and dime. But that's what it is. They are really very cheap. For those of you who are familiar with Pakistan, the median school's fee is roughly rupees 150 a month. Okay. For those of you who have gone to Islamabad, 150 rupees a month is not going to give you
a McDonald's burger in the hotel, right?
No. I'll give you an example because I just checked, and my wife and I had an argument. What's the most expensive dessert in Islamabad? It's in a place called Hotspot. Hotspot brownie is 600 rupees.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I'll give you an example, right? It's in Islamabad. This is where most expats and everybody goes. So this is 150 rupees a month. So the question is, you know, how can you have something at 150 rupees a month, right? When you get stuff, right, I mean, when you get something like this now at $10, right, you ask yourself, you know, how can this thing be made for 10 bucks, right? It's made in China, right? So then the question is, there's got to be cost, right? I mean, the guy who is making this is making some profit. So for him to make some profit, the costs have to be even lower, right? So it's really coming in from the cost side, right? And the cost is low wages. This is a very nice graph. wages. Okay. So government school salaries, right? This is current government school salaries. This is data that we have collected ourselves. Current government school salaries, roughly a teacher earns, including benefits, is something like 5,500 rupees, the median salary for a teacher right now. Okay. In our samples, the survey that we are conducting ourselves, we have data on 4,000 teachers. In three districts in Punjab, okay, rural Punjab. The government school teachers, about 5,500 rupees. In fact,
per month.
5,500 rupees per month. In fact, women make a little bit more in government schools, just a little bit, but they're in significantly different men and women salaries in government schools. Private schools, on the other hand, typical teacher salary is 1,100 rupees a month. Okay, 1/5. Of a government school teacher. And there is a very significant premium for females. A premium meaning a significant discount, a negative premium for females. Females are the ones who actually make about 1,000 rupees, men make roughly around 1,500 rupees median. So we are 1 to 5 in terms of salaries as far as private versus government schools are concerned. The teacher profile in these private schools is really interesting. Okay, private school teachers are largely single, are largely local, are largely female, and are relatively young. Okay, this is basically, again, to give you kind of this Pakistani flavor to it, they're mostly young, I would call them, you know, young women who are not married yet. Okay. And typically waiting to get married. I can see my graph here, so I can give you the numbers. Government school female teachers are 43%. Private school female teachers are 76%. So 3/4 of teachers in private schools are female. The mean age in public schools, government schools, is 38. In private schools, is 25. 15% of government school teachers, this is our data, 4,000 teachers, 15% of government school teachers are single, 77% of private school teachers are single. Government school, 25% of government school teachers were born in the same village that they are teaching in, 52% of private school teachers are born in the same village that they are teaching in. So they dramatically different profile. They're two different populations. There's no way you can think of them as the same population, as drawing from the same population, right? In a statistical sense. Teacher characteristics. Private school teachers are less educated, less experienced, less trained. Okay, I'll give you the numbers and read them off mine. For instance, beyond high school, about 50% of government school teachers have more than a high school education. In fact, marginal. If you look at the last teachers recruited within the last 5 years, almost all teachers, government schools, recruited within the last 5 years have a B.A. degree, which is a 14-year education in Pakistan. In private schools, in our data, only 20% of teachers are beyond high school. So mostly they are girls who have finished high school. Okay, in private schools. Government schools, training, some training is a requirement. Okay, teacher training, right? These are bachelor's in education, there's a certificate in training, primary teacher certificate, those kinds of things. It's a requirement. Less than 15% of private school teachers have any teacher certification. This is what we call, I think in the US it's called teacher certification. Teaching experience, in our data, more than 80% of government school teachers have more than 3 years experience. Private schools, only 40%, less than 40, have more than 3 years experience. Government school teachers, once they are posted, it's interesting. In Pakistan, there's a big discussion that there's a lot of posting transfers of teachers. What we are finding is about 2/3 of teachers have been in the same school for more than 3 years. Private schools, very little. In fact, something like 1/3 of private school teachers that we surveyed were in the first year of their teaching. Okay. It's a very young population, lots of turnover. Okay. So teacher salaries, controlling for their characteristics, right? Age, experience, education. What you find in private schools is that the female penalty is 33%. Okay, the females get paid 33% less, and if you are a local, in addition, you are paid 23% less. Okay, so local females really are, but it depends, right? I mean, which way you want to look at it, right? I mean, local females is really where the cost advantage is coming from. Okay.
Which you can say as a gentleman.
No, it's interesting, right? I mean, when we talk about it, you can say the government can't do it, right? This is our if you go to the next one, this is our main point, okay? We have done a second paper which details this in great detail. Okay? I mean, we talk about it econometrically very seriously. I mean, basically what we are seeing, okay, is that there are very serious cultural constraints on female mobility in Pakistan, okay? If you look at people who move across villages, and you look at females, you can see it in very different data sources. You look at it in the census, you look at it in these household surveys, and in our own survey. If you look at women moving across villages, okay, why do women move? I don't think it's surprised, right? You think of migration, right? You think it's a male thing, right? Males migrate to work. Actually, in the census in Pakistan, women migrate as much as men. Why?
Marriage.
Women only move in Pakistan when they get married, not for work, because most of them don't work in the formal labor market. And what is interesting is men don't move to rural areas, right? Work-based migration is all rural women. People go to Karachi, people go to Lahore to work from villages. But there is a significant, right, to rural migration is almost all women. Women, a lot of it is rural to rural, some urban to rural, but not getting married. But what is interesting is married women usually don't work in Pakistan, right? So that's interesting, right? Women who move typically don't work. And so women who work typically don't move. And that's the key, right? Which is what is happening is that, I'm too much of an economist, right? I mean, wages are determined in some sort of a supply-demand equilibrium, right? And we think there's a global equilibrium, right? There's a global supply of labor, and let's say a province-wide, Punjab-wide supply of labor, or a district-wide supply of labor, and there's a district-wide demand for labor, right? Those two curves intersect, and that's what we get, right? Out comes an equilibrium wage. Here, what is happening is you have very large numbers of segmented labor markets. So wages are determined in kind of these local supply-demand conditions. And what happens is wages are dramatically lower where supply of moderately educated women is lower. Okay. And people who think of the demand side, right, typically think of the following, right? Let's say you are living in a village 100 miles from here. There's actually demand for education there, right? For some reason, right? Some historical reason, you know, your father moved to Dubai, came back, wants to educate his girls. But there's nobody to teach those girls. Now, in an integrated market economy, what will happen is demand for education will rise there, which means that somebody out there in the market will be willing to pay teachers more. But here there is a supply of educated women, let's say in this village, they will move. Like I moved all the way from Pakistan to California, right? And people move all the time, right? I mean, that's how labor market equilibrium works. but not in this economy. So if there is a demand for education over there and a supply of women here, hands are weak. And the people who move are men, but men have outside options. There's no way you're going to get a man for 1,000 rupees a month in Pakistan. Right, the dihari, right? Dihari is unskilled work, right? Unskilled work in Pakistan right now. If you go to Islamabad on the street, 400 people who stand on the street to pick up bricks, that's about 120 rupees a day for men. Right? That's complete unskilled, non-contractual labor, right? So, you know, we are talking about very low cost here, okay? And private schools take advantage of that. So it really is a supply side story, which is very, you know, so, and we see it in the data very dramatically. And this is a striking finding. This is our, this is the basis of our next paper, which is a very serious econometric paper, which we spent too much time on, because they were, you know, we want to do it right. And this is a striking finding, okay, which is where do private schools locate, right? So where are the, where do these women exist, right? Basically what we are saying is private schools emerge in these villages where these women exist, and they exist in pockets. Okay, and the pockets are not connected. Okay, so think about that. Right? Well, what we find is, you know, where would these women exist? Well, these women exist where a generation ago government girls' schools were set up. We have looked at government school data, right? So we have, this is, by the way, right, this is a huge data collection exercise. We have taken the population census, we have taken educational management information system, which is the government's educational information system, which has all government school data. We have taken a census of private schools and then household surveys and merging them together. Now, merging most of the federal government data is not that bad, but with the provincial government data does not have a common coding with the federal government. If, you know, aid people can do one thing which can make life a lot simpler for everybody in the world, is for different groups in Pakistan to develop a common database coding, right? We had to match by name, by village. Okay, there are 50,000 villages in Pakistan, okay, where the schools are. And names are so misspelled. Like, think about it, right? Muhammad is spelled like six different ways. Ahmed is spelled eight different ways. Sometimes in the same field. So I had my computer science students write a fuzzy matching algorithm. It is to you know, it's called the Lerenstein method, which does, right? I mean, it gets rid of all vowels and things to do this. It took 8 months for us to do that. Okay, we were seven people. So it's a lot of work to be able to do this. Government schools create the supply of educated women. Okay, so, you know, typically people think of government and the private schools as substitutes, right? This is how the Punjab Education Department thinks. We had to actually educate the secretary. We had to sit down with him, I mean, over days, trying to convince him that he is not the secretary of government schools. He's the secretary of education in Punjab. Okay, so, I mean, he thinks of his policy as market share. You know, I mean, that's just nonsense, right? I mean, there's so much education being provided by non-government schools. And typically, government schools think that private schools take away girls from them. And in fact, demand-driven policies, you know, conditional cash transfers, stipend-based policies, all stipend-based policies in Pakistan right now are only on government schools. All free textbook policies in Pakistan are only on government schools. Okay, so, you know, we're going to see that fact. I mean, you know, it's not going to do much if a girl moves from a private school to a government school, right? From the girl's method point, it's okay, but from overall enrollment point of view, right, it's not a market share game going on in Pakistan, right? I mean, which is what the planners need to understand. That they are not just the chief executives of a department which has 260,000 teachers. They are custodians of education in the country. It really annoys me, no end. And we have told them, and they say they'll do something about it. I'll give you an example, okay? This is a very table, which is that villages which did not have girls primary or secondary school at all, right? Only 12% of those villages have private schools. Villages which received a girl's secondary school in the last 20 years. There was a big school construction in Pakistan in the 80s. Pakistan has, right, I mean, has received these sine waves of aid. over the last 25 years. And when you look at the 80s AIDS program, right, there's a 6-5-year plan, 1980 to 85, and then tapering into 87, 88, which is then, I guess that's when somewhere down the AIDS cut, I don't know exactly when. But there was a big school construction at that point, which you see this big bump. And so girls, villages that received schools in that period, 31% of those villages have private schools today. Okay, and you can see it from the number of educated women per village now. We have matched the 98 census of villages in Punjab only. It's too much work. To the 1981 census. So we have a panel of data from 81 to 98. Try to do it in Sindh. Those of you who know Sindhi, Sindhi has too many sounds like her, her. They can misspell so badly, dhambarlo, khambarlo. In English, forget it. I mean, if you want to work with a database that is translated from Sindhi to English, it's impossible to do it. So that's why you didn't, not that Punjab was much better, but what we see in Punjab is the following. Schools that, villages that did not get girls' primary schools have, okay, 12 women who have more than 10 grades of education. 12 in a whole village. Villages that received girls primary and secondary in the last 20 years have 27. So very clearly it more than doubles. And you can do it as a fraction of population too, and it's the main thing is still there. Limitations. Our private schools, they don't exist everywhere because of these pockets. They exist in larger villages and with better infrastructure. That's a fact. Okay. For example, the census of Pakistan gives us very good infrastructure numbers on villages. The way the census is conducted is they first conduct a dwelling census. Okay, so we have very good data in Pakistan on structures. Okay, so for example, permanent houses built of concrete. Villages with a private school, 60% of houses are made of concrete. Villages without private school is 36%. Potable water in Pakistan is a serious issue. Villages with a private school, 15% have water. Villages without private school, 9%. Electricity, 73% with private schools, 43% without. So larger, better infrastructure. Mostly at Punjab and some NWFP phenomenon, okay? NWFP has a lot of private schools. So that's interesting, right? I mean, Christine and I have been talking about Pata, which is a dwelling NWFP for most part. The one has to be careful, right? NWFP also has Hazara, which is really not Pashtun speaking. NWFP has a pretty big chunk. My sense is maybe, I don't know the exact population distribution, but probably 30% at least of population of NWFP is non Pashtun Hazara, right? Mm-hmm. That's why this debate on changing the name of the province from this British, you know, frontier province to Pashtun, Khwa, Pashtunistan, you know, that's where it stumbles on, is the non Pashtun. So some of it is coming from there. Hazara is a big chunk of private school, but it's all over Peshawar, Mardan, in the central districts, as they say, right, not the tribal. You see a big chunk. In fact, roughly, NWFP has about 18% of villages that are private schools. Punjab is about 25%. Okay. The big problem is Sindh. Sindh has the least amount of private schools, and most NGO schools are in Sindh. So Sindh has very few for-profit schools.
About Baluchistan?
Baluchistan is not there. Mm-hmm. Baluchistan is I hate to say things about Baluchistan because it stands apart from the rest of Pakistan in the data so much that, you know, it's almost like a study in itself, right? When you do Pakistani data, it's very clear now. I mean, from your point of view, right, people who are looking at these border areas, frontier for most part is very well integrated into Pakistan as an economy is concerned. Okay, there's a lot of economic integration. I think that's why there is. It's interesting, you know, how Pata stands out, because frontier prices, frontier education data, very much looks like Punjab now. You know, there is so much segregation in frontier, right, with towns and all. But even given that, it does look to be the places that stand apart are rural Sindh and Baluchistan. Rural Sindh and Baluchistan are different. Okay, by whatever measure you want to use. Okay. And by the way, I did this work during the earthquake. I'm doing a lot of work now post-earthquake. And AJK I don't know if you knew it, Kashmir, right? Kashmir has the best education numbers in Pakistan.
Yeah.
And the highest private schooling penetration in Pakistan is in Kashmir. I actually am doing a project now there. I was there this summer, and it's just amazing as the number of educated women, especially if you come from heartland Punjab. The numbers are phenomenally different. And I think that I'm starting a project there with some people now on an intervention. I just think it's an amazing resource in Pakistan. It hasn't been utilized. I mean, I just can't imagine those women, right? If you think of what is happening in Punjab private schools with such limited number of women, per village numbers in Kashmir percentages are double that of Punjab. So it really is something waiting, a good revolution waiting to happen. I mean, I think we really can do it, and I really am going to try something there. There are very strong vertical limitations. Okay, this is very different from the U.S., right? In the U.S., where is most private education? It's a inverted pyramid, right? And mostly public education is at the primary level. Universities, I teach at a private university. Most people I know, a lot of people go to public, private universities up here. Mostly in the world, that is true. In Pakistan, that is not true. And we think that's not going to happen. I'm in a discussion with the most ambitious education project in Pakistan. I'm an advisor with this university, Young's, on the science and engineering. The costs are American costs. Setting up a science and engineering school to do is American costs. You can't get people, let's put it this way, right? If you want somebody to teach a physics lab, you're not going to get them ₹1,000 a month. So very few schools are going to be very strong horizontal base. Not likely to extend to secondary schooling. So we don't think that it's a rural-based primary schooling is going to extend to secondary schooling. That might be an interesting division between government and private schools. Where they exist, the poor do use them. I'll just give you one number on it, which is in villages that have a private school, 13% of enrollment in private schools comes from the poor, the bottom third of the population. This is pretty high. 13% of people who go to private schools in villages that do have them are poor, okay? And if you compare them to villages that don't have private schools, there the fraction of enrollment by the rich is 11%. So we are saying that there is a difference, right? Where people have access, private schools are affordable, right? So there's a difference between accessibility and affordability here, okay? Private schools don't exist everywhere, but where they do exist, they're used by all sorts of people. Okay, 13% is a very large number. Females enrolled is much higher in private school. In villages that have private schools, female enrollment is very high. In fact, I'll give you an example. In Leeds, we divided villages into settlements. We have done very detailed mapping of 120 villages. What we find is that in settlements that do not have a private school, females are 16 percentage points less as far as enrollment in schools are concerned. Huh? 16 percentage points, not 16%.
Yeah. I mean, would I be useful for folks like, for example, at USAID? I mean, my instinct would be that's because the schools are closer to the families. So the sort of honor constraints of movement might be less restrictive.
That's very true. In fact,
and then also the fact that there are, one of the determinants of female education is the presence of female teachers, which obviously where you have these pockets of private schools, that issue is obviated. So it might be useful to sort of draw out for folks in USAID the implications of
that. My sense is, I think the first issue is more important than the second one. First issue is, I think, really important.
The proximity.
Is basically what private schools have done, and if you go to the villages, that's what you will see, is what private schools have done, wherever they exist, is increase the density of schooling. Okay. We are doing this study on you know, school choice and distance very carefully. And what we find is, see, people have just looked at distance and PIHS type data sets and they say how far is the school. What we are finding is some of these schools are really close. And people, by and large, send their kids to the closest school they have. And for girls, we think that's exactly right. So for instance, the male-female enrollment difference is 16 percentage points where there are no private schools, and where there are private schools, it's only 8 percentage points. So female enrollment roughly doubles, and we are doing this very carefully. So it,
No, and if I could hop in here, I mean, we must remember with educating females, the returns to that investment are much higher. The more educated they are, the more likely they are to be in marriage, and they have lower fertility. So it may seem silly that we're focusing on female education, but that is really where you get a huge return to your investment. I'm sorry.
No. From my sense, that's very true. But, you know, we are pointing out an additional benefit, right, which is educated females. Our paper, which is specifically on this point, is called Students Today, Teachers Tomorrow. There is a, I can tell you, right, with this EFA business, Education for All, Millennium Development Goals, there is a global teacher shortage. Most clearly in Africa. So this stuff is very relevant for what's going on in Africa, with a teacher shortage. Very clearly in Pakistan. And I think that this work is only now starting to be done in India. It hasn't been done properly there because of lack of data, I think. But I think there's a very big teacher shortage in India too, if you want to educate all these people. So I think educated females, I think, I would submit that's our contribution to this debate, which is that we have pointed out this additional channel. So you have to understand, teaching is the single largest profession for females in Pakistan right now. Okay? So this paper, right, I mean, we can talk about education as such, but this is really about female labor force employment as well. I mean, I'm very interested in female labor force participation, I think. And schooling is just about the best possible thing that can happen, right? You can work in these in schools for 2 or 3 years. It doesn't require too much of an investment. They are close to your home. We have found that private schools, most female teachers live within 15 minutes of the school. So. What about quality? This is a new stuff, right? Quality, right? Quality is very complicated. Education inputs and outputs, right? I mean, forget. I mean, in the U.S. too, right? No child left behind. All that we've studied very carefully. Yeah. And
no child
it's complicated, right? I mean, family, child, school, administration, teacher, the child's internal motivation, parental characteristics, parental motivation. You read your kid. You know. What did you do with your kid last night? All kinds of things go into what determines output. So not easy to disentangle. But anyway, we try to do it. I can tell you, I mean, in the World Bank, we are the only ones who are doing this very massive set of questionnaires which are trying to give the entire educational environment of a child. We look at households, we look at children themselves, we take diaries of kids, what they're doing all day, we talk to households, how much did they read, what did they do, all kinds of stuff. We have very detailed stuff on teachers, on head teachers, which is supposed to get at administration, then schools, which is supposed to get at infrastructure, all kinds of stuff. And then we do tests. We did a lot of stuff. Test scores. So we did this test. I piloted these tests myself, and I've gone into, I did it in 30 schools by myself. I've gone into them, looked at maybe 700 kids, looked at every single kid. And we did Urdu, English, mathematics, and civics. Yeah, civics is not scored in the usual sense, right? We gave it, this particular data is on 12,000 class 3 children. We have been tracking these 12,000 children for 3 years now. And now a second cohort of another 12,000 kids. So this year, as we speak right now, we are testing 25,000 kids. And now this cohort, the data I'm presenting, it has finished fifth grade. So this is the first study where we are actually now tracking a transition from primary to secondary. So all kinds of issues with child labor, dropouts, what is happening with girls, boys, within school, housework, we will get them in a panel. There's no other data set like that. And you're getting some really interesting stuff. Quality. Okay, so you know, this is a big question, right? Private schools, less educated teachers, less paid, less experienced, less trained. What would you say? Right? If you were to design a policy, you would get, that's what they say, right? Get more educated teachers, pay them well, train them, and you know, and their experience.
Could I ask you, I'm not clear on if there is actually access. You're saying it's rural, poor areas. Do they compete with government schools, or are there no government schools?
No, there are government schools.
So in a village, you would have another option. Do they have options?
Let me just say, this particular testing is done, that's a good one, I should have said that. This particular data, right, the universe is villages which have more than one school, okay, so the representative, which is about in Punjab, that is about total of maybe 8,000 villages out of 24,000. Okay, so this is about what we would say is these are rural large villages. It's rural, it's not urban, but within rural, it's larger villages. That description.
So, and what is the cost of the government school?
The government school, the cost to the student is free.
It's free.
But the cost to the society is very
much. I'm just trying to get a comparison. looking at
the cost is nominal. It's nominal. It's right. Well, there's a 2 rupee or 3 rupee. So what we get is the following. These are gaps. Okay. The red bars are the adjusted and the unadjusted. I'll tell you what it is. Unadjusted is just the raw difference. And these are knowledge scores. This is done on item response theory. This is exactly the incomprehensible thing that in California you get with your teacher scores. Okay. And what we find is huge differences. In English, this difference is one standard deviation. Remember from your basic stats course, two standard deviations is 95% of the population. If your two standard deviations high, you're 95%. One standard deviation is roughly 50%. So the difference is really large. And adjusted means we are controlling for household income, parental education, child wealth, child, you know, things like that. So even controlling for those, these are gaps. These are very large gaps between public and private. This is the test to give you an absolute level. We have a very long test. This is just a sample. There are about 90 questions in there. But look at the absolute numbers. It's pretty low. I don't know. What can your kids do?
I tried this test for my kids, but you know, my son is in second grade. And he can do a lot of it, not all of it though. I mean, 238 minus 129 he can do in second grade. And 4 times 32, not yet. But this is given to people at the end of the third grade. The differences are pretty large. And look at the addition subtraction question, right? End of third grade, 39% of private schools can do that, 29% in government schools. English, the numbers are very dramatic. English is compulsory. English is a complicated issue in Pakistan. I mean, we can get into it if you want. Now, in the US, I'll just take 2 more minutes. In the US, the issue is, people say it's household variation that matters. School variation is much less, right? If you look at between school variation is less, household variation they say is more. In Pakistan, what we are finding is exactly the reverse. Difference between schools explains most of the difference between kids learning. It's not household where it's coming from. But the gap in English, and these are just numbers, gap in English is 15 times the gap between what we are getting between rich and poor children. If you move a rich kid into the same school and a poor kid into the same school, their scores will become very similar. 10 times the gap between children with illiterate and literate fathers. 14 times in Urdu the gap between literate and illiterate mothers. Household characteristics seem to matter less in explaining variation coming from schools. Right? Oh, well. Teacher absenteeism, we get data, government school teachers are more absent, we don't have very good data. But we have some data, we have actual data, but it's more. Well, why don't you go down? You just scroll down all the way. Just keep on scrolling down all the way. I just want to say, maybe these are all the graphs that we're supposed to come. Yes?
President Ravi, I have a very quick question. Is there any behavioral issues in either the private schools or the public schools? I'm somewhat curious to see why poor kids and rich kids don't have much of a gap. I was wondering whether or not if behavioral issue, are behavioral issues part of the equation at all?
No, because I think what we're seeing is I think it's coming from school governments. I mean, we're not fully ready to say that, but it's very clearly coming from there. Okay, this is what you get, right? Student test scores and teacher compensation. This is a pretty serious graph, okay? Okay, so the x-axis is the student test scores. The y-axis is the difference in salary that the teacher gets as a percentage of average salary. Okay, the red graph is public schools, right? Public schools, you see, for most part, I mean, if you stop it right here, right? If you stop, what do you see? Mm-hmm. Downward slope, right? as student test scores increase, salaries are falling, right? Private school, you see a very clear upward slope, right? Students who are paid more, students who do better, their teachers are paid more. Government schools, no such thing we find. Next, teacher absenteeism and compensation. This is a great graph. Okay, go ahead. Okay, private school teachers, private sector pays more absent teachers less. The blue. Okay, because we have absenteeism data, right? Government school, teachers who are absent more get paid more. What do you think? It's not that they have a deliberate policy of paying absent teachers more, right? It just happens that way, right? Why?
Seniority. They get paid for
seniority.
Absolutely.
Right. Seniority is the single largest predictor of salaries in government schools.
Yeah.
They are the ones. Okay, what next? Teacher governance, value added. We are doing a lot of value added stuff over time. There's some interventions we are trying to test, school councils and things like that in our data. Dropouts and repeaters, very big issue. Listen, the bottom line is the following. I mean, we are interested in what is happening in Pakistan. Is this country going to explode, implode? In a mess, with extremism and all this, it's okay to focus on Fatah, it's okay to focus on a madrasa. The real issue in Pakistan is, year after year, 2 million kids are coming into adulthood with very marginal scale. I think that, I mean, given this worse, I mean, it's almost clear to me that a big chunk of my life from here on is going to be devoted to understanding what the hell is going to happen to these kids. These are kids who are, I tell you, they are just marginally educated. We have to now have a category. The last 20 years enrollment push has resulted in kids who are barely literate. And what happens with them as they enter into adulthood, what kinds of things they will do, they will become young adults, older parents, and so on, is the single largest issue facing Pakistan. And we have to deal with it. We have to work at it. We have to figure out how do these kids learn. Most of these kids are dropping out. Yeah, repeaters, you can't imagine how many kids fail in Pakistan. It's done with impunity. Pakistani education system needs a massive, massive overhaul. And we think that that's really the thing. It's not easy. And so there are no quick fixes there, okay? But we just need to go on and on. Okay.
Did you want to issue?
Just, thank you, Professor Andrabi. I just wanted to add one or two points, really just questions for our discussion. I know a lot of us do have questions. I like this sort of dichotomy between the private and the government schools and sort of where the private schools are picking up where the government schools have failed in so many different areas. I was wondering if you could just, I know you studied the stats, and this schooling business for profitability, it raises a lot of questions, in terms, for me at least, for curriculum, textbooks, infrastructure, all these other things that are related to profit. Do the teachers have a say? I mean, what's the relationship between the teachers and administration of these profit businesses? Is it just several businessmen in a rural village that decide that this is what would help us out? The other question is this. Related to types of schools. When you speak about private schools, it's still a little fuzzy. What types of private schools? You said they're not religious schools, obviously. But do they include Montessori schools, mainly? Or Montessori type of schools? And this is just sort of a clarification. And I guess a larger big picture question. I know you talked a lot of stuff was done. Details of micro. My big picture question is, what are the implications for the trends of education for those who have, if you look at supply side education, are you saying that more and more families will decide that private schools is more profitable in terms of careers, in terms of future, in terms of social mobility? Are you saying that there'll be a crisis within government schools, with there'll be more of a shift in the next generation from moving from government schools to private schools, given this upward trend with private schools? And if that's sort of your conclusion, then what is the sort of conversation happening within the Secretary of Education who thinks that government schools are okay or fine? So those are the sort of questions I put out based on your analysis.
I might just add one to that, because I know there are folks around the table that have questions.
One big question.
Yeah, but the one thing that might be also useful to sort of think, this has been a supply-side picture, as you said. But if you take a look at enrollments, for example, in the United States, one of the biggest drivers of that was return to that investment in the labor market. And when you look at the Pakistan economy, most of the families are agriculturally employed, small business owners. By small business owners, what we really mean are these really small shops, not small business in the American context, and then government employment. So if you actually think about the opportunities for there to be returns in investment, that's also not optimistic. So if you were to sort of just take a step back, like for example, some Arab states, relative to the return to that investment, actually overinvest in education. So how do you sort of link up the connections between education reform and the fact that you really need to have some kind of return to that investment to get demand for education kick-started? Pamela.
Sorry, I just want to add my question on to that, because I was really interested in the supply-side approach. And I'm not sure I 100% understand what the dynamics are, because you were very clear in the beginning that, you know, one of the reasons that the cost can be kept so low is you have this captive pool of young women who are not mobile, can't move to another place for a higher salary, and who are willing to teach. I'm wondering if these schools, if one of the outcomes may be, I mean, if the school population is a high percentage women, are you just perpetuating a captive labor pool that will not actually be able to do very much with their education? Their opportunities aren't there. And if you think about if these were young men, we'd be really worried. Here we would be giving them enough education so that they would have very, expectations of being able to better themselves, no opportunity to better themselves, we would know we're going to have an explosive situation. Not to get into gender studies here, but it's a very interesting dynamic that you've brought up. And so your thoughts on that would be.
I can quickly respond, and then we can take the second round. First is the for-profit business is really interesting. In Pakistan, generally, when you talk to, if you look at the newspapers and all that, right? I mean, for-profit is considered like a slander, right? A gully, as they say. They are for-profit, and very looked down upon them. You know, I what we are finding is that these for-profit, what is very interesting is we think that for-profit is the key, because for-profit is the one that is creating the management structure. Because these teachers are, really what they are is that owner teacher. Okay, so the owner himself is the teacher, mm-hmm. typically the school principal, and teaches one class and so on. So is present, on site, is there. And a lot of it is husband-wife teams.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the wife also teaches, and then the daughter also teaches, and then somebody comes in. So it's a classic kind of a family enterprise. And then there's some cousin comes in, and then boom, then the neighbor comes in, and so on. Okay. So in that sense, I think there's a for-profit part. The curriculum has to be, the government of Pakistan has a very interesting policy on curriculum. Every place that requires a transfer certificate, right, where you can transfer to another government school, has to follow the government curriculum. Okay, so the curriculum has to be government. Textbooks can be there are three or four different kinds of textbooks. Now, the government of Pakistan follows the principle of additionality, which means you can teach other stuff. Okay, so you can teach you like computer science, mm-hmm. but you have to have the same, all of them have the same curriculum. What we found is that teachers are slightly more empowered. We have lots of details on teachers, what kind of lesson planning do they do, what kind of autonomy do they have, what kind of discussions they have very clearly. Mm-hmm. Within class, they are more autonomous. Private schools of what type? Most of these are primary schools. I mean, basically what happens is they start off with like one grade. Right, so the first year they will have whatever kids they have. It's a multi-grade, there will be like maybe 15 kids. Some second, some third, fourth. Within like 2 years, the school becomes more regular, mostly private. What we are observing this phenomenon in real time. This is not a steady market. It is not like doing an industry study in the U.S. where you look at something that has been around for hundreds of years. These schools, every year they are changing. So this is just a snapshot. And what we are seeing now in the secondary school market, we have seen in a lot of places now in Pakistan. Because secondary school shortage is very clear in government. Primary school shortage, there isn't that much of a shortage in government. Secondary school is, most of these schools now just keep the sixth grade girls. So de facto start a sixth grade, even though they are primary school. You see a lot of girls just continuing on primary school and in secondary. So mostly primary, there is, in Pakistan, the issue of 4-5 year olds is an unstudied issue. You pointed out a very big issue, which is in data, there is this thing called Kachi, which is kindergarten and unadmit. There's a very large category in government which is called unadmitted kids in government schooling. So lots of kids in this lower end. We don't know what these kids are doing in school. They are just hanging out, they're in there. Some government data looked at it very carefully. There is a very big component of kids who are just there. They are called unadmitted kids, kindergartner kids. So I don't know exactly what is happening at the first year of education, right? It is, maybe that was your question. On the big picture, I think private schools market share is increasing. In rural areas, government market share is falling. And it's at all expenditure decile. It's at all expenditure decile. People are moving towards these schools. So I think this is, the 2005 National Education Census has information, I know that. And I think what we are going to see is even bigger explosion. I mean, I think this thing is just all over. Government is reacting. Government is spending a lot of money in Pakistan now on education. A lot of it on secondary schooling, so there is lots of responses. We think the biggest issue is teacher governance. You know, I mean, education is a very simple exercise. I mean, teaching kids in second grade doesn't take rocket science. At minimum, what you need is a teacher to be present and actively engaged. That's all you need. Okay, not much. Okay, 2 + 4, 238 - 139 doesn't take that much. So, present, actively engaged teachers. That's all we need, right? That should be the end of reform in Pakistani government schools. That's what you want. And I think you're going to see a difference there. And I think it's hard. It's hard to figure out how that's going to happen. Chris's point is a deep point, okay? That's a difficult question, which is the rate of return. Mark Rosenzweig at Harvard, now at Yale, that's his comment on our work, which is, he is of the view that education shifts happen when there are drastic changes in rates of return. Okay? The thing is that, for example, his work in India is Green Revolution. Villages that had Green Revolution technology, demand side, right? Increased rate of agricultural rates of return, huge increases in education next generation. That's a demand side. In Pakistan, right? Remember, right? I mean, what we're trying to capture is cross-sectional variation. Right? So, I mean, it's very difficult to figure out, where the differences in rates of return are. I am trying to think of the demand side story, really working hard at it. I would come up with a nice story, which really say that why, right? I mean, because some places it's happening, some places it is not, right? There are two things. One thing is very clear, right? In 1991, we had the Nawaz Sharif liberalization. Yeah. I think that has something to do with this. Mm-hmm. But I can't get it variation enough, right? We are trying to look at television, right, which is awareness. And television, I mean, I think Pakistan television, pre-satellite, I think was a very big factor, we have done interviews on this, in creating role models for women, positive, all over the place. So I think that it's not just about rate of return, especially for women, right? Rosenzweig's work in India has shown marriage prospects change, very clearly Pakistan.
Well, rate of return doesn't have to be necessarily money, it can be social rates of return,
so I think that
marital
some of that women. Marital prospects clearly are changing with women, some norms are shifting. But as I said, it's a difficult problem to do anything about. It's not an easy one, at least for us to answer. But we would love to. If you had a nice story, you would have a killer paper.
Because in the Indian case, you actually have diminishing margins of return for women's education. There's a point at which where it's desirable, but then afterwards there's diminishing margins of return. So it depends on what state.
Yeah,
wherever.
You have to be very careful, right? So in villages, for example, Anjani Kochar has said in India, I'll tell you the one I'm familiar with. Anjani Kochar looks at like migration opportunities and things like that.
So you have to know a lot to calculate a rate of return. What are the potential opportunities that can exist in places? Along with me, very clearly it's migration. Men it's migration. I don't know about women. And women's rate of return is complicated, right? Rosenzweig says he has done the most work on it. He says that men like to marry educated women, not per se, because they become better home teachers for their kids, who have then male kids have higher rate of return.
That's right.
So mothers
then get better brides with better dowry.
Yeah, so things like that, right? You are going. I'd like to take a different spin on it. I am actually interested in this kind of gender angle very much. I don't think of this what we are describing as a negative phenomenon for these women. Okay, I mean, I think that you understand, right? I mean, I have gone to Pakistan where people now say in rural Pakistan that it is easier for women to get a job as a teacher than a man to get a job, period. Okay, I think this is just about, as far as, you know, I mean, if you're living in the world of art of possible, right? In the world of possibilities, not thinking of first best. But if you're living in the world of possibilities, I think what is private schools are creating an option for these women, which is just very dramatic. And the next generation, what you will see, what I hope is you will see two kinds of deepening. One is horizontal expansion, but then vertical deepening, right, which is towards secondary school. So within the same village, you will see a lot more investment in education within the community. There still need more investment in education. So I think if the second generation pool, I'm very optimistic on certainly rural Punjab. Okay, I think in Pakistan for the first time the median girl is in school. Okay, and I think all these stories about demand for reform, demand for good governance on the demand side, right, come from this educated middle class. What is very clearly happening, which all these discussions in Pakistan in popular press, I'm having this argument with Pervez Woodboy right now, who's a friend of mine. I mean, I don't think he understands this phenomenon, which is we are now seeing an emergence of a rural middle class in Pakistan. Pakistani villages, if you go in Punjab, go within 100 miles of Lahore. This is about 25 to 30% of Pakistani population, probably even more. Okay, just draw a circle around Lahore, right? And what you are seeing is very high growth enrollment rates and rural middle class emerging. So my sense is that Pakistani villages now don't look like villages. Larger villages. The larger phenomenon, I think it's now starting, it's fair to create a third category, which is what we are looking at. I mean, I really think your question is on the mark, which is, these things really should not be called rural in the right sense of the word where we are going. I think there has to be a new category, right? Peri-urban. Peri-urban is really being thought of as just adjoining urban area. But you know, what you are seeing is, some of these villages are very large, 5,000, 6,000 population, that's not a small place. So we are seeing this kind of a third category emerging in Pakistan, where I think most of the action in Pakistan is. It's not in Karachi and Lahore, and it's not, from my point of view, if you think of a parental choice point of view, and it's not out there on the Lahore border. It's the heartland where the action is happening, and this is where it is. And I think for those girls, so in that context, I'm very worried about rural set. I really am. I mean, I started working on this bank project and I really can't sleep now because I'm looking at the data. I think rural Sindh is becoming where the narrative is now like the indigenous people's narrative, which is that they are shrinking and their way of life is going to just be finished. I think Sindhi as a group, I don't know what's going to happen to them. Not in this area. This area is flourishing, I tell you, as far as education is concerned. You have to see them.
You speak from as an economist, and I'm looking more at the qualitative part. As you tell the story, it reminds me of a similar movement in the United States in homeschooling. Yeah. And here you've got people who are focusing, not necessarily religious-based, but many people, and they are not teachers. You know, they prefer to stay home. They may have an education, but some of the people who are teaching in homeschooling would probably be similar to the teachers that you're talking about in your private schools. And so there's a qualitative and a different emphasis on what education means. Have you looked at the movement in the United States when you're looking at homeschooling and the movement in Pakistan?
That's a good point. I'll tell you one thing. There is a clear similarity, which I haven't said in the data, which is not in our data, but in my field visits, I've seen this a lot. A lot of these women, right, how do they get their start? What they get their start is they start off by just getting a few people in their home and starting doing after-hours teaching or teaching on their own. So this is, a lot of these private schools are in homes. So this is home-based in that sense very clearly. There is a very clear family-type atmosphere to these places. And there is some informality to it. There is a similarity with the U.S. more generally, right? Which is teaching, you know. Teaching was the only profession open to women here too, like, you know, turn of the century. So that, you know, it's very interesting. U.S. is also talking about teacher shortage. Right? If you look at the U.S. data, right? Type teacher shortage. The first 20 hits you get is the U.S. in Google, right? And it's interesting. How come there's a teacher shortage? There are more educated people than you can imagine, right? In the U.S. Well, why? Because women have options. Right? I mean, it's very interesting. In the U.S., a big issue is, so the captive women issue is that 100 years ago, there were lots, you know, lots of the best women were in teaching because that was the only thing open to them. Now that's not the case. So I think we're going to see that in Pakistan too, right? Which is, I mean, we're seeing in real time some evolution like that in Pakistan, which is once opportunities open to the women, I don't think they're going to teaching. But I think we are quite a ways from there right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, Professor. My name is Vanessa Pierre. I'm a Haitian American, and I teach in Prince William County. And Prince William County has seen a very, very big influx of Pakistani students in the past 5 years. I have two students in my high school class in the ESOL. Two very bright girls, super intelligent. Their parents have told them that even though they are very smart, they need to start looking for a trade. They need to find something technical to do because they are going to marry them next year. And marriage has been imposed on them before they even wanted to look into that. I'm comparing the scenario in Brazil with the book by Paulo Freire, The Pedagogy of the Oppressed. Is it possible that, even though you didn't cover that part, that perhaps there is a religious pedagogy of the oppressed tailored toward girls, that the demand for education is not necessary because, you know, if you have enough education to be a good wife, that's sufficient. In that context, do you feel or do you see the possibility of a Pakistani Paulo Freire telling the upper class that, you know what, at some point we are going to have a serious demand for women in high-tech jobs and so on and so forth? What is your insight on that?
Couple of things. I mean, I think that first of all, what is considered normal for a woman to be educated? What is required? You know, there's a very famous book, 19th century Bhishti Zewar. Everybody should read it to get a sense of where all our gender problems come from.
It's the jewels of heaven, right?
Yeah. That's what it was. The requirements means for a good wife in the 19th century. So when you say requirements for a good wife, immediately my sense goes to that. I haven't read it. But you know, it's
by
I don't recommend it. Yeah. I'm not using it. I don't care. But you know, what is required in a good wife? The standards are changing, right? I mean, I asked my Pomona students, right? I mean, who are they going to marry? They're going to marry somebody just like themselves. There's a sort of mating in the U.S. People marry people like themselves. So that is changing. What is the requirement of a good wife? Very dramatically in Pakistan. What I see in Pakistan is Pakistan is especially this area where the norms are completely breaking. I mean, you know, I think this population can go either way. They can go any which way. I mean, they are the first people who are really coming into the 20th century right now. I mean, first time they're getting educated and so on. So I see the situation as very fluid in this part. I don't see this as a rigid situation which is trapped in its past, like that this population that I'm looking at. It's a very large number of people, okay, which I think is close to becoming the modal population. On the oppressed, I want to say a different. I have friends who say that, and I endorse it now. I've looked at these schools. Pakistani school might be the worst environment for education in the world. They are the most boring schools in the world. That's a fact, right? I mean, so when people said, you know, what's your problem with the madrasa? My problem with the madrasa is not always extremism. That might be the issue. It is just bad, bad education. Pakistani schools generally, not the madrasa, right? We have looked at the time of day, what these kids do. There is no play in these schools. They are such regimented schools. I think that's a very serious problem. I mean, we think if we drop out, that's a very big issue. I wouldn't go to those schools, I tell you. If I were in those schools, I would have dropped out.
Couple of points, Carola Vile from USIP. Two things I want to come back to that were raised by my colleagues. One is this question of investment and also how you get beyond primary school supply side or demand side problem. You were providing a very optimistic future, particularly for the semi-rural village, large village type communities, where you're saying, well, if you simply have enough and growing phenomenon of primary school, female educated opportunities, eventually that will expand both horizontally and vertically. That there will be an investment. The problem is, who is doing the investing? Mm-hmm. If it's not coming from government, and it's not a demand side driven phenomenon, it's not clear to me that there is some automatic mechanism in there that kicks you from a primary school level to a secondary school advancement, for example. Because if you can make money simply, which is what Pamela was saying, essentially you can make money by having these relatively low-level teachers in schools, that there is no incentive, no market incentive to go beyond that. Unless you have a value change which says we need more high-skilled people because of the labor pool, because of the labor market. That's one question. The other is the current education reform that's going on, and I know there was just a new white paper published by the education ministry. To what extent is that debate addressing the private school phenomenon at all? Do you know, is there, and particularly on this qualitative side, is there any effort to extend the educational reform in terms of content to the private schools, or is it something that is simply limited still on the public school side? And just a final comment on the question on the issue of norms breaking down. I would also question you on how much those norms are really breaking down, because my very limited experience, even with educated, or especially with educated women in Pakistan, has been that they feel these constraints, the traditional constraints, as much as they always had. They find they have more opportunities to get around the constraints, but the constraints themselves have not necessarily changed. So you can have a single educated woman with a post-secondary school degree from the US or the UK or somewhere, who still ends up having to be in a situation where she either has to live at home, or she has to live with her brothers, or she has to live with an uncle, and really has very limited mobility and choice in what happens. So I would just put that out as perhaps a caution that the constraints themselves may not in fact be changing quite as rapidly as we think they are.
Quick
comment
on that, working in reverse. Third question. They are changing. This is actual data, okay? I just looked at it. Median marriage age, 1955. What was it in Pakistan?
11?
No.
16? 16.
Median marriage age, 1995. 22. I mean, things are changing. I think that's a very big change. Fertility has very clearly changed. In Pakistan, right, in the 70s, fertility was hitting, I think, like the biological maximum. I imagine it was, you couldn't imagine it being more than what it was. Fertility is clearly dropping. Fertility has dropped in statistically, we can see it in the data. Number of kids. I mean, I think that these are two very big factors in women's welfare. So I think those are definitely changing. I did not say it's all over the place, right? This is, as I said, this is in progress.
it's happening. I definitely don't think secondary schooling for profit can succeed in Pakistan. It cannot. So I think one of the things from the government's point of view, I think governments will have to make a serious investment in middle school. Governments would have to make a very serious investment in high school. I'm talking to the Higher Education Commission in terms of colleges, high school, colleges meaning 12 to 14 in Pakistan. I think those places for government will definitely be very much there and are needed. So I think that the supply argument simply says that creating education begets more education. Education is very different. If you, let's say you're a lady health worker, right? You treat somebody. That's the service you provide. You don't create a lady health worker. Education, the service you provide, you create a service provider. I mean, that's why this is so interesting. That's a supply phenomenon where education is so different from any other public service. You provide water, you don't create a water provider. But you teach, educate somebody, that's a potential teacher. And I think that's really the highlight that we want, which is, and that creates a vicious cycle, I mean, very clearly. So that what that says is, I really think that in Pakistan, you know, in many places, since for sure we are in a vicious cycle. I really do. But I think that these vicious cycles, there are so many models that we think about of breaking out of vicious cycles. And I think that the supply phenomenon says that you can have a snowball effect, there's just one more channel. We know that education creates more incentive for people to become further increased education. My work has mostly been provincial governments. Education providers are provincial governments. There's no point in working with the federal government if you want to really look at reform in terms of teachers. Federal government has, you know, controls 340 schools in Islamabad. So if you are interested in, you know, nit grit of teacher incentives, teacher postings, teacher stuff, then you have to work with the provinces. Pakistan is strange, right? Federal government is in charge of the curriculum. My sense is curriculum should be with the provinces. Pakistan has such provincial heterogeneity that the federal ministry is dealing with curriculum. You know, it's you know, they do whatever they want to do. So there is a huge curricular debate, right, which we are not part of. I mean, it's a pretty interesting one.
How tied in is this with the devolution of local governance? I mean, some ministries have been, you know, have gone down to the Nazim level, who has control. Where does education fit with power devolution?
Education is devolved, but whatever your sense of the devolution project.
Nonsense.
No, I mean it is. It's education is devolved. This is I give you a personal anecdote. We are randomizing in our schools, right? The government of Punjab is doing a school management committee project, right? We want to test it. Pakistan and the world over, there are so many school management committees. It's like the big buzzword in everything, right? I said I have a school management committee. Local participation, etc., etc. You know, nobody has really tested whether they work properly or not. So we were doing this randomized thing, right? So we wanted the Punjab government, we have this set of schools, 800 schools we are tracking. We said, do it in 400 of those schools. Huh? They're doing it in 11,000 schools. So we said, but don't do it in these other 400. And we gave them a list, right? Because coming from random, so because we want to have a control group. So the secretary says, fine. Okay, done, right? So we give them a list, it's done. And then we have a person in the field who says, no, in one of our schools, the school management committee is being set up. So I call the secretary and I said, what happened? He said, it was okay. I'm calling from the US. And he says, talk to the Atak Nazim. And the Atak Nazim basically, you know, said, who the hell is the secretary? he just said, it's going to happen in the school. But the interesting thing is, you know, basically, I think they act as feudal, right? So next time we went, we did a hazri, right? We said, oh, sir, please don't, you know, why are you doing this? Yes. And, you know, so we made a special visit to the Atak Nazim. And he just wanted to be treated like royalty. Atak Nazim is the person on whose seat Shaukat Aziz is on.
Absolutely.
So he's a very powerful man, much more powerful than the World Bank contractor, who's the secretary of education. You know, sorry, very.
Sir, what do you see the prospects of public-private partnership in promoting education in Pakistan? We are witnessing the ongoing reform process in Pakistan, and the government is doing a lot, which is evident from the increase of the budgeted amount from about $34 billion to about 254 billion rupees. I quoted dollar in the first place. From 34 billion rupees to 254 billion rupees over a period of 3 years. So, where do you place this prospects of public and private sector partnership in promoting education in Pakistan?
Public-private partnership is a very misunderstood term. At one level, I really do not understand what they're talking about in terms of specific projects. There are some specific projects. The government of Pakistan has a very schizophrenic attitude towards private schools. I mean, at one point they say, they are bad, this, the price gouge, etc. And then they say, oh, why don't you take over dysfunctional government schools? Okay. So I think that's one of the projects that have been tried out in various places. I'm not sure. Pakistan, there is a lot of stuff happening in reform.
CARE is a very successful model.
Yeah, I haven't looked at it. My sense is, at a large scale level, I'm not sure exactly what they mean. I think, in Bangladesh, for instance, private schools are aided. Pakistani private schools are completely unaided schools. These are not subsidized in any way. There is no voucher, there is no support for these schools. I looked at models in Chile, in Belgium, I was looking at data. Most private schools in the world are aided by government. I mean, these schools are trying to fend the government off.
Did you say they get curriculum and you get materials from the
government? No, material. Curriculum is a constraint. It's not an aid. It just says you have to do something. They don't provide anything. Curriculum is a list of things that they need to keep.
Okay. That's it.
As far as I'm concerned, it's a constraint. It's not a support. Pakistani government curriculum, I tell you, is so hard. If they implement it in California, there will be a revolt of parents.
Oh, yeah.
Pakistani, if a Pakistani kid in fifth grade is actually knows what he's supposed to know or she's supposed to know, they'll be way ahead of Taiwan and test scores.
I thought for a while, if you could just forget about the government the teachers and talk about the parents. I think about what we saw in Atlasa was like, I think, a couple of hundred miles from Lahore and Hyderabad, was that parents think that they should not send their kids to school because kids should become carpenters or learn sets. Do you think parents have never been approached as a strategy overall? You always talked about approaching the teachers or the governments, but never the parents.
Yeah, that's what I would want to demand intervention, right? My focus in this case deliberately has been on the supply, which is teachers and government and so on. Parents, I mean, is
because
for a second. I mean, there is a very huge demand. I'll tell you what is coming from parents is demand for English. This private school movement is almost entirely driven by the demand for English. All of the private schools, if you look at their advertisement board, right, the board on billboards, all of them say English medium.
Yeah.
Whether they are or not is a different story.
Right.
So the parental demand, at one level, this demand for trade and stuff is okay, but overwhelming demand that we see is in Pakistan to be even considered. In Pakistan, I consider to be considered a human being, right? Is if somebody in the government treats you with half decent, response when you go somewhere, right? I think the rate of return in Pakistan is crossing the level from being this category which is not even citizens or humans. Into that human category, and I think you need education, some status for that. I mean, I disagree with this, what you're saying a little bit, because I really do think that there are these people in Pakistan who are really yearning to be part of normal society, to take their rights a little bit, where some of what they are, what their rights are given to them. I think giving education to them really allows them to navigate this whole morass of really the constraints that the rest of society imposes on them. I really think education allows them to navigate through that.
That's the point, that's what you think. But we just did a couple series of programs in Punjab, in Sindh, and in the frontier, and what we found out was that parents thought that sending kids to school did not really matter, because if they spend 4 hours at a school,
they think that the kids could actually spend some time stitching footballs and make more money for the family. So I wanted your comment
on it.
Okay, you know what? Actually, I've got to intervene here because we are, all of us, well, Pamela and I are running to the airport for a conference, and they're going to kick us out of this room in a couple of minutes. So, I mean, this is something that you guys might want to continue. But I know Pamela... Yeah, actually, that might be a very interesting idea if you have time. But I know Pamela and I, we're getting really nervous about having to run home and pack our suitcases and fly to the airport.
This has been fascinating.
This is really
good. Thank you very much.
This has just been a wonderful conversation.
Great audience, by the way.